Section 2.1, Introduction. Last time, I discussed Peter Singer's famous pond example, which has profoundly affected many people's views regarding our obligations to the needy. I noted that Singer's example helped give rise to the effective altruist view that people ought to effectively support the most effective and important international relief and development organizations, or aid groups for short, which aim to help those in the poorest countries facing premature death or severely debilitating conditions due to poverty, famine, war, tyranny, ignorance, or disease. Singer's example, which is on your handout, goes as follows. If I'm walking past a shallow pond and I see a child drowning in it, I ought to wade in and pull the child out. This will mean getting my clothes muddy, but this is insignificant. While the death of the child would presumably be a very bad thing. I noted my longstanding sympathy with Singer's and effective altruism's aims, but argued for a pluralistic approach to aiding the needy rather than the narrow monistic do the most good approach of effective altruism. I also claimed that Singer's example doesn't take us very far in telling us what we should do, all things considered, to aid the needy. In this lecture, I raise further worries about the relevance of Singer's example to whether we should be donating to aid groups. An outline of the talk is on your handout. Section 2.2, expert observers and intervening agents. One obvious disanalogy between Singer's example and giving to aid groups is that in the former, I personally and directly save someone. While in the latter, my goal requires the cooperation and intervention of others. Singer implies that this difference isn't significant. He writes, I quote, "Experts sent out by famine relief organizations can direct our aid to a refugee in Bengal almost as effectively as we could get it to someone on our own block. So not literally as effectively, but almost as effectively, and that's good enough." For years, I assumed Singer was surely right about this. I now believe this important claim warrants scrutiny. To see why, let me first note the scope of the issue. When I send money to an aid group, it is not as if, to borrow an example from Francis Cannon, I'm reaching across the ocean with super long arms and plucking a drowning child out of a pond. Rather, I'm relying on a bevy of intermediaries to act on my behalf. How many? It's difficult to say. And of course, it will vary case by case. Someone will process my check or credit card in some office, say in Boston. If I'm an American, I send off my check to Oxfam America, as I do every year, it goes to Boston. Others will decide how my contribution is spent based on the input of local employees, on-the-ground agents overseas, Board of Governor members, and so on. Eventually, my gift will be transferred into some operations account. If all goes well, my gift will arrive in some poor country, say Somalia, where various people will have access to the funds. They will decide what to do with the funds based on input from various local people, and of course, oversight in theory from the Home Office back in Boston. Next, someone will direct people to buy relevant supplies. Others may then transport those supplies to an area of need. Others will take delivery of the supplies. Eventually, they will end up in the hands of those who will actually dispense them, say nurses or doctors or food distributors. Only then will someone in need actually benefit from my gift. Moreover, throughout this process, there may be many local, state, or national officials or others with whom the aid group must cooperate to work in the areas of greatest need. Thus, when dealing with large aid groups, many intervening agents will be involved in executing my intentions. In Singer's example, only one person executes my intentions, and that person is me. Is this difference significant? It might be. Unfortunately, the more agents who stand between me and my will's execution, the more something may go awry, whether intentionally or not. and whether for nefarious reasons or not. This disanalogy between Singer's example and giving to large aid groups is generally ignored, I believe, far too lightly. Section 2.3, saving lives versus supporting effective aid groups. Singer and his followers want us to believe that since, I'm going to repeat this multiple times because it's a key claim, a hugely important claim that's just kind of quickly put into the article and everyone just assumes it must be right, that since experts sent out by famine relief organizations can direct our aid to a refugee in Bengal almost as effectively as we could get to someone on our own block, then giving to an effective aid group is equivalent to saving lives. But however well-intentioned and however plausible it may be on average at the individual level, this claim is highly dubious. Perhaps in giving to an effective aid group, you will in fact be saving a life, but perhaps not. When I wade into the pond, I know exactly what I will be doing when rooting my clothes. By hypothesis, I am saving a child. But money is fungible, and while aid groups may solicit funds by telling donors that their gifts will be used to save lives, the reality is that the gifts may end up paying or helping to pay for any of the following: salaries, rent, utility bills, office supplies, fundraising brochures, mailing costs, gas, vehicle repairs, food and alcohol when key congressmen or leaders are lobbied to support the group's efforts, and so on. Likewise, aid groups may promote education, female empowerment, or food production. In that case, your gift may help pay for teacher salaries, books, or school desks, or fabric dyes, store supplies, or restaurant appliances, or an ox, plow, or fertilizer. I want to stress these are all perfectly legitimate expenses that any reputable aid group may incur. I'm not saying they're wasting your money if they spend your money on these things. There's nothing nefarious or inappropriate about such expenditures, and they may all be well worthy of our support. Still, intuitively, the difference between saving a child's life and paying for most of these other expenses seems sufficiently great that it casts doubt on the purported analogy between the obligation to save a drowning child and the obligation to contribute to effective groups, aid groups. Consider, for example, the following case, which is on your hand. The drowning child and the honest aid worker. Nick's only luxury item is a $5,000 Rolex willed to him by his favorite uncle. Because of its value, the watch has a complex clasp that makes it impossible to remove quickly. One day, as Nick is out walking, he spots a drowning child on one side of the street and a crippled aid worker on the other side. I'm waiting for Q&A to answer why it's a crippled aid worker. Before Nick can save the child, the aid worker quickly gives him the following pitch. I work for an effective aid group. On average, for every $5,000 donated, we promote a total amount of good equivalent to the good produced by saving two drowning children. But admittedly, we promote many worthy goals and we must incur many expenses to attain those results. If you save the drowning child, your watch will be ruined. If you give me your watch, I will sell it for $5,000 and every penny will go into our general operating fund. We will only draw on your gift to pay for legitimate expenses. Accordingly, you can think of your gift as paying a small share of each of our expenditures. Salaries, rent, utility bills, office goods, transportation costs, food, medicine, education materials, small business supplies for women, farm equipment, and so on. The aid worker's pitch would earn high marks for honesty, but I'm guessing it would be ineffective. Even if Nick completely believed that the proceeds from his watch would only be used for the aid group's legitimate expenses, and he further believed that on average, for every $5,000 the aid group spent, it produced a total amount of good equivalent to the good produced by saving two children, intuitively, it seems clear that Nick should save the drowning child. Singer can assert that experts sent out by famine relief organizations can direct our aid to a refugee in Bengal almost effectively as we could get it to someone on our own block. However, what I actually do in the pond example, an old friend's face just popped up in a recognizable form. Personally and directly saving an innocent life is very different from what I do when I contribute to an aid group. Personally sending a check that helps defray the group's many expenses, which together with others' contributions, promotes any number of valuable causes, goals, which may include saving lives, but may also include educating children, empowering women, improving living conditions, providing health care for debilitating but non-fatal illnesses, and so on. Intuitively, there are compelling reasons to save the drowning child, both in Singer's original example and in my example. Of course, our intuitions may be mistaken. I have not argued otherwise. Still, these considerations suggest that it's a mistake to argue that we have a moral obligation to give to the most effective aid groups based on our intuitive reaction to the pond example. In my first lecture, I argued that there are many moral reasons to help the needy, including consequentialist-based, virtue-based, and deontological-based reasons. I wasn't just saying that, I mean that. There are tons of them. Together, these reasons, they're very powerful. These reasons may often support giving to effective aid groups. Still, while there will be overlap in the kinds of reasons for supporting aid groups and the kinds of reasons for saving a drowning child, it is, I believe, a mistake to imply that the obligation to support effective aid groups is basically the same as the obligation to save a drowning child, or that the former directly follows from the latter. I don't see that. Section 2.4. The dark side of humanity and worries about corruption. Most people who have known me for most of my life would have never believed that I could ever write a section like this. That includes me. I have noted some perfectly legitimate reasons why a donor's gift may be spent in ways other than the donor intended. But some potential donors worry that their money may be diverted for more nefarious reasons. Good-hearted people tend to ignore such worries. However, I believe this is counterproductive, and it plays into the hands of aid opponents who claim that its proponents are naive. Since these lectures aim to be as clear-eyed as possible, I think we should take this worry seriously. To do so, I begin by pushing a line that is ugly and disturbing. It concerns people's corruptibility and potential baseness. I shouldn't really even have to argue this. I should just say read the newspaper every damn day for a week, but I'm going to argue it anyway. I begin with some observations. First, I was recently warned by a good friend to empty my mom's home of any valuables before bringing a caregiver in to stay with her. When I asked him why, he gave me a very simple answer. Because, he said, everybody steals. I was appalled by my friend's advice, and I thought that he had a very sad and jaded view of human nature. I still think that. And yet, on reflection, many people I know have had valuables stolen by workmen, maids, friends, and even relatives. Indeed, my mom herself had a trusted handyman of many, many years forged three of her checks for thousands of dollars. Second, the old saying, a lock is for an honest person, dovetails with that part of the Lord's Prayer which goes, lead us not into temptation. Unfortunately for many, weakness of the will is a common phenomenon and temptations are hard to resist. Hence the necessity of locks to keep honest people honest and the daily prayers of millions that they should not be led into temptation. Jonathan Glover's powerful book, and if you haven't read it, I strongly recommend it to you. It's an amazing book. Very sad, but amazing book. Humanity, A Moral History of the 20th Century, contains a litany of man's inhumanity to man, and it's largely, sadly, it is man's and not humans, but man's inhumanity to man over the course of the 20th century. Touching on countless examples of repression, rape, torture, murder, starvation, massacre, firebombing, chemical warfare, nuclear devastation, terrorism, enslavement, and so on, spanning the globe. And while it's easy to blame the 20th century's great horrors on a few evil men, such as Hitler, Stalin, Mao, the reality is, as we all know, that they never could have happened without the complicity of legions of ordinary people. The 340,000 deaths at Hiroshima and Nagasaki resulted not merely from Harry Truman's decision, but from the combined efforts of countless people just doing their jobs. Pilots, mechanics, engineers, scientists, drivers, factory workers, secretaries, and so on. They all contributed. We all contribute. And the up-close and personal atrocities of the Holocaust, the My Lai Massacre, the Killing Fields, the Gulag Archipelago, and the Rwandan Genocide were typically committed by young men who were God-fearing, law-abiding citizens, devoted family members, and hard-working students, farmers, factory workers, or professionals. Moreover, the infamous Milgram and prison guards, prisoners' experiments reveals how quickly ordinary people can be led to treat others cruelly or turn on others outside the context of famine, war, political instability, or historical animosities. None of that needs to be in play for humans to turn on each other like that. This phenomenon is sadly known to any sports fan, or even more sadly, any parent of young competitors. Of course, I recognize that the full story of humanity includes love, hope, kindness, and generosity, as well as hate, desperation, cruelty, and selfishness. Still, given that far too many normal people are capable of the most abominable acts depending on their circumstances, including rape, murder, torture, and enslavement, is it unduly pessimistic or merely realistic to worry about the possibility of people lying, cheating, or stealing if the opportunity arose to benefit themselves or their loved ones? In Seeger's Pond example, whether I save the child is solely up to me. When I send a check to an aid group, any number of intervening agents might have the opportunity to divert my contributions for their own purposes, and any one of them might do so. Might. It's just a might. Thus, one obvious disanalogy between the Pond example and supporting aid groups is that the latter gives rise to worries about organizational corruption that the former does not. It's not wise, I think, to simply sweep such worries aside with the claim that expert observers could direct our aid to a refugee in Bengal almost as effectively as we could get it to someone on our own block. Section 2.5, responses to the worry about corruption, further worries, and more responses. Before proceeding, let me consider several responses to the corruption worry as so far presented. I've received these responses from numerous people, so I know that real people, probably many of you, some of you certainly have these in your head as I give these arguments. The first goes as follows. Look, those who work for aid groups are not typical. They genuinely want to make the world better. They often work long hours at low pay in difficult conditions. Surely, we don't have to worry that such people will be corrupt and steal funds that were sent to the needy. This response is sweet. I've heard it from many people, but it's naive. People join honorable professions for many reasons, and not all are honorable. Moreover, some people may join with the noblest of intentions, but lose their bearings along the way. No faculty member who has ever kind of cheated on their expense accounts ever started out as a young faculty member thinking they would do that. Somewhere along the way. Consider an analogous claim regarding policemen or priests. Those who work for police departments or churches are not typical. They genuinely want to make the world better. They often work long hours at low pay in difficult conditions. Surely, it might be thought, we don't have to worry about the behavior of such people. Yet, sadly, there have been no shortage of policemen and priests who have abused their positions for personal gratification, often preying on their community's most vulnerable members. Likewise, stories abound about trusted scout leaders, teachers, and coaches who have abused young children in their care, about health providers putting profits before patients, about academics doing research that serves the interests of their funding agencies, including the military, tobacco companies, and the sugar industry, about investment advisors betraying the trust of vulnerable customers, and so on and so on and so on. Stories abound also of charities that supposedly aid the poor, sick, orphans, or veterans that turn out to be scams or fronts for terrorist organizations. In sum, while no doubt, and I mean this, no doubt, most aid workers are above reproach, it's naive to suppose that aid groups, by their very nature, are immune to worries about corruption. In fact, the natural tendency of people to trust charities will serve as a beacon to some scoundrels seeking to take advantage of that fact. We don't have to like that. We can abhor that. But we shouldn't pretend it isn't so. A second response to worries about organizational corruption is to follow effective altruism and only support the most effective aid groups as ascertained by independent agencies that are themselves above reproach. This response to this is fine in principle, but in practice, I have my doubts about it. Unfortunately, there are thousands of aid groups, and the resources of evaluating agencies are limited. Manpower, economic, all sorts of resources. Thus, evaluators largely depend on information provided to them by the principals of the groups that they are evaluating. Clearly, if those providing the information are corrupt, they will cook the books to cover up their malfeasance. But as importantly, and I really think this is probably even much more importantly, even if those providing the information are not personally corrupt, they would themselves would never engage in the kind of activities I'm alluding to. If their livelihoods depend on their group's success, or as importantly, if they deeply believe in their group's goals, then they will have every reason to paint the rosiest possible picture of their group's effectiveness. One of the most striking lessons from notable scandals is how often leaders who are above reproach in their personal conduct have gone to great lengths to cover up any organizational wrongdoing so as to protect the organization's image and not lose the trust of their supporters. Moreover, they have done so even when this puts other vulnerable people at risk of the same sort of heinous actions they are covering up. This has been so with the financial industry, the Catholic Church, the Boy Scouts, boarding schools, universities, and countless other large-scale organizations. Given this, how much confidence can one really place in the accuracy of any large organization's reports as to its own integrity and accountability? Unfortunately, if an aid group hopes to generate revenues to support its worthy goals based on its effectiveness, there will be strong pressure to oversell its successes and to undersell its failures. Moreover, As with any group depending on the trust of its customers, shareholders, or supporters, there will be powerful incentive for an A group to not look for, or to even cover up, any evidence of substantial wrongdoing. Less people send their donations elsewhere. Right? This is what's happened right now to the Red Cross. People aren't sending their donations to the Red Cross when it becomes apparent what happened with the donated money to Haiti. Thus, in an industry increasingly judged by the efficacy of its results, there's increasing reason to worry about the trustworthiness of self-reports. Moreover, the more independent firms work with A groups, the more difficult it may become to retain their impartiality. Also, whenever large sums are involved, corruption worries arise, as there can be powerful incentives, money, drugs, sex, jobs, for an evaluator to give a favorable report. Thus, organizational corruption worries can only be partly laid to rest by appealing to the evaluations of independent agencies. Many potential aid donors are much less worried about internal corruption than about external corruption. Their concern is that in order to aid the needy, aid workers will require the cooperation of corrupt people outside the organization for which they will have to pay. Let us explore this worry further. In many places, what we regard as corruption is deeply woven into the fabric of society. Often doing any kind of business requires the permission of local, state, or national authorities who expect payment for their cooperation. Sadly, this tends to be particularly prevalent in some of the world's poorest regions where the need is greatest, including regions that are war-torn, poverty-stricken, politically unstable, or dominated by dictators, warlords, or gangs. Corrupt officials have many ways of securing a piece of the international aid pie. They may demand bribes up front, or more subtly, require permit fees to work in the region. You want to work in this region? Sure. $100 a day permit fee. Goes into somebody's coffers. Or they may allow food, medicine, supplies, and money to flow directly to needy individuals, and then tax or demand kickbacks from the aid recipients. This was a common lesson from the Vietnam War. Some of you, most of you won't be old enough to remember this, but U.S. troops would go in during the day, and they would bring all this equipment and all this stuff to help the farmers in the villages, and they would leave at day, and at night the Viet Cong would come in and they would take 50% of everything that was brought in. That number is just made up, the 50%. I don't remember what the statistic is, but it's a very common phenomenon in many places in Vietnam. Thus, some funds given solely to aid the needy may end up lining the pockets of corrupt people in many countries where aid groups operate. Many people recognize the problem of corrupt officials within some countries where the need is greatest. But they contend that non-governmental organizations, NGOs, can largely avoid the problem. I've heard this response a lot. Supposedly, NGOs can operate directly to benefit the needy, bypassing government officials who might siphon off aid resources for their own purposes. I find this position unconvincing. NGO or not, any group operating in a foreign land will need the approval and cooperation of the relevant power brokers. Hence, I fear that powerful and corrupt dictators, generals, warlords, chiefs, gang leaders, policemen, politicians, or local leaders will find a way, directly or indirectly, to get a piece of whatever aid flows into their regions, whether it's from an NGO or not. A second response is to grant that some aid resources may end up lining the pockets of corrupt individuals, but to learn to live with it. Let us explore this response further. To a certain extent, as you will hear, this is my favorite response. That is, the one I actually favor. But only to a certain extent, sadly, at the end of the day. Consider first the Old Testament story of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, two cities supposedly teeming with sinners. As the story goes, Abraham argues with God, asking him to spare the cities if 50 righteous people can be found within them, and then lowering the threshold in turn to 45, to 40, to 30, to 20, and finally to 10. If there's just 10 righteous people, God agrees that he will spare Sodom and Gomorrah. One important lesson the story explicitly teaches us is that it's better to allow many sinners to thrive than to unjustly take even 10 innocent lives. One needn't be religious to believe there's something deeply important about this lesson. I believe that. I hope some of you do too. Accordingly, one might similarly believe that if the cost of saving some innocent people from death by starvation, disease, disaster, or war is to line the pockets of some corrupt officials, that's a cost worth bearing. Of course, it may make one sick to think about how many others might have been helped with the money that corrupt officials spend on palatial mansions, fancy cars, and other luxury items. Still, on this view, if the alternatives are doing nothing and letting innocents die, or saving some innocents, but at the cost of enriching some corrupt individuals, one should hold one's nose and do the latter. Next, consider a more mundane issue. Many consumer products come from elsewhere in the world. Only a small fraction of the price of coffee, sneakers, or TVs goes to pay for the raw materials and the salaries of the workers who produce such products. The rest, the overwhelming majority, pays for the countless intervening costs that must be borne to bring the products to market. Rent, insurance, transportation, packaging, managerial salaries, advertising, storage, dividends, and so on. In the modern global economy, most people, virtually everybody in this room, has learned to live with this. We have done so even though, at some level, we are well aware that often the workers producing the goods are exploited, and that often most of the profits from the items we buy ends up lining the pockets of owners, businessmen, stockholders, government officials, and others, at least some of whom engage in questionable business practices or corrupt behavior. As long as they get the products they want, most consumers don't ask too many questions about where the money from their purchases ends up. But then, if we're willing to condone such a view, as most of us implicitly do, for the sake of trivial products like a cup of coffee, I know some of you don't think that's trivial, depends on what time of the morning it is, for such trivial products as a cup of coffee, a pair of sneakers, or a TV, shouldn't we be able to accept similar consequences for the sake of saving innocent lives? How come people are so worried about the problem of corruption and where their money is ending up when the discussion turns to contributions to aid groups? When they basically ignore such questions when it comes to the purchase of consumer goods? Consider next the following example. Indira is considering giving $5,000 to a charity. I know I should say 5,000 pounds. I'm so sorry. it's so rude of me. I just can't be bothered. And I would have to change the numbers. If you had $5,000, we'd have to be 3,700 pounds. And that's an awkward number for me. You know, I'm sorry. Forgive my rudeness. With the money, the $5,000, Charity Aid would provide costly medical care to someone in a remote village, thereby saving one innocent life. And Charity A is corruption-free. Charity B would provide moderately costly medical care to people in a moderately remote village, thereby saving three innocent lives, but must deal with a mildly corrupt local chief who extorts 10% of the aid group's supplies. And Charity C would provide inexpensive medical care in an easily accessible city, thereby saving six innocent lives, but must deal with a very corrupt gang leader who extorts 50% of the group's supplies, which he'd spend on Mercedes. It burns Indira up to think that half of her gift will go to a selfish gang leader when so many people are dying. If she could, she would give to a corruption-free charity that would save 12 lives with her gift rather than only 6. Still, if her only options are charities A, B, or C, she may well reason that it's better to save 6 lives and help pay for a gang leader's Mercedes than to only save 3 lives or only 1 life, even though in the latter case, none of her gift would be lost to corruption. The preceding suggests that in giving to charities, we should not lose sight of our main goal in doing so. Arguably, if our goal is to save lives, then we should give to whatever A group will best do so, even if this requires lining the pockets of some corrupt people. On this view, we ought not to allow our distaste for evil people flourishing to prevent us from helping as many people as we can. There is, I believe, much to be said for this view. Minimally, I don't see the justification for holding aid groups to a higher standard than coffee, sneaker, or TV businesses. Still, as we'll see next, there are many possible direct, indirect, and long-term effects of corruption that make this issue much more complicated than so far discussed. Section 2.6. Accidents versus social injustices and problems in dealing with the devil. Let me turn next to some other respects in which Singer's Pond example may or may not be analogous to aiding the needy. Regarding Singer's example, most people assume that the child's drowning is a terrible accident. That is, we assume that neither the child nor any other agent is responsible for its plight. Moreover, importantly, no one stands to gain from the child's being saved in the sense that no one would be better off as a result of saving the child than they would have been had the child not been drowning in the first place. The terrible accident feature of the pond example is replicated in many cases of disease or natural disasters. And in such cases, there will be many reasons to help the victims, akin to those for helping an accidentally drowning child. Unfortunately, however, the terrible accident feature of the pond example is lacking in many cases where people are needy. Often the world's needy are so as the result of grave social injustices, inequality, discrimination, persecution, neglectful governments, unjust war, enslavement, torture, attempted genocide, and so on. Of course, the victims may be every bit as innocent and every bit as deserving of aid as the drowning child. However, other agents being responsible for their plight introduces a complicating element, not present in the pond example. Moreover, often the perpetrators of the worst social injustices are largely beyond the law's reach. Tyrants, warlords, politicians, army officers, secret police, or gangs. This introduces a further complication not present in the pond example, where one might plausibly assume that an agent would be subject to punishment if he or she had intentionally tried to drown a child. The no one stands to gain aspect of the pond example, in the sense of course the child stands to gain, but I mean in the sense of being better off as a result of our intervention than they would have been had the needy not been in dire straits in the first place, is also lacking in most cases where aid efforts are involved. As we will see, this disanalogy introduces further complications in considering the desirability of contributing to aid groups. Let us next explore some ways in which these disanalogies may be normatively significant. To begin, Let's focus on cases where the needy are victims of social injustice. How might this bear on the desirability of aiding the needy? Consider first a simple example. Suppose Hugh credibly threatens to kill an innocent person unless we give him $5,000. Might be unwise to give in to his demands. Doing so is likely to embolden Hugh to make similar threats against us and others in the future, and to incentivize other evil people to act in similar ways. Ultimately, this may cause far more people to be threatened with death than if we refuse to cooperate. It may also cause far more people to die due to misunderstandings or mistakes, or when some people are simply unable or unwilling to give in to such demands, and the extortionists then kill their victims to prove that their threats are credible. The global proliferation of kidnapping for ransom reveals the long-term dangers of giving in to such demands. Of course, where a loved one is involved, one may be compelled to cooperate with such rogues. That's why it's so successful. But this is a classic case where if each of us does what is best for their families, it increases the risk and produces greater harm overall. Thus, there are powerful reasons, at least where one's loved ones are not involved, to not give in to such demands. Next, let us vary this story. Hugh sets in motion events that would result in an innocent person dying. He then tells us that he will save that person or allow someone else to save that person, but only if we give him $5,000. Here, too, there are powerful reasons to resist. Of course, if we could temporarily cooperate and then bring Hugh to justice, that would be another matter. In that case, neither he nor anyone else would have incentive to pursue such activities in the future. But if there's a strong chance that Hugh will get away with it and that our cooperation will provide others with the perverse incentive to act as Hugh did, then there will be strong reasons to resist. Now, sadly, in some cases, not all, but in some cases where the need is greatest due to grave social injustices, those responsible may be tyrants, warlords, or gang leaders, or basically outside the reach of the law. They basically are the law. Moreover, as the effective power in the region, these people may benefit in direct and indirect ways from efforts to aid the victims of social injustice, buttressing their positions and enabling them to continue perpetrating great injustices against the very people we seek to help or against other innocent victims. Moreover, if our interventions do buttress their positions, this will not be lost on despots elsewhere, who will see that certain crimes do pay, and thus be motivated to perpetrate similar injustices within their domains as a way of increasing their power. To be sure, to some extent, this is worst-case scenario speculation. Much more needs to be said about the mechanisms I'm alluding to and their global prevalence. But the point is that in Singer's example, no one stands to gain from my intervention beyond the position they would have been in had the predicament never occurred. Whereas, tragically, many of the world's neediest people are so due to social injustices perpetrated by evil people who may stand to gain from efforts to help their victims. The latter situation is fraught with moral complexities that the former lacks. Accordingly, the clear intuition that of course we ought to save the drowning child doesn't entail that of course we ought to contribute to aid groups, as so many people seem to have thought. Attention must be paid to any negative effects of our doing the latter, including any perverse incentives that our actions give rise to. Whereas by hypothesis, there are no negative indirect effects from our doing the former. Consider the following series of examples. Imagine that Mook, a Hutu chief, has destroyed a Tutsi village's cattle, and blockaded the village. An aid group seeks to supply the villagers with desperately needed food and medicine. Mook agrees on one condition. The group's head must kill each Tutsi firstborn male. Or the group must supply Mook with Uzis, these are submachine guns, which may then be used against Tutsis. Or the group must supply Mook's village with food and medicine, hire Mook's villagers for all local tasks, or pay a daily permit fee to work in the region, none of which directly harms Tutsis, but all of which bolsters Mook's status and power, enabling him to commit similar atrocities in the future and incentivizing other warlords to commit similar atrocities and drive similar bargains to increase their power and standing. I presume that no aid group has been asked to fulfill the first demand, to themselves kill innocents. However, I suspect that most aid groups operating in regions where genocide or brutal sectarian violence are background conditions have faced versions of the other demands. More than suspect, actually. I have very good reason to believe. When they do, the deeply complicated problem of dirty hands arises. When, if ever, is it morally permissible or required to deal with the devil for the sake of promoting good? This real-world problem does not arise in Singer's example. It's everywhere where aid groups are working. Let me next make some comments regarding the preceding. First, one might hold that I have a duty to aid victims of accidents or natural disasters or victims that I'm responsible for, but no duty to aid the victims of other agents. This, I believe, is a deep mistake. If an agent is responsible for another's plight, they may well have the primary responsibility to help, but if they fail to do so, then my duty to aid would be just as great as if the person's plight resulted from a natural disaster. So to my mind, the fact that others may have an even stronger duty to aid someone in need, and that the person wouldn't require my aid if others fulfilled their duties, doesn't lessen my duty to help in those cases where the others don't fulfill their duties. Second, on one strand of deontology, I am responsible for what I do, but not, except in special circumstances, for what others do. On this view, if I provide a warlord with cash, food, or medicine, which he then converts to weapons to kill innocents, or even if I provide him with guns as the price for aiding the needy, as has happened in the real world, I can be morally comfortable in doing so. The lives I save go on my moral ledger, while any lives the warlord takes goes on his moral ledger, or her. There are many hard questions about when, if at all, one agent can be responsible for another's actions that I cannot pursue here. But my own view is that I can be partly responsible for an evil agent's actions if I could have easily and safely intervened but failed to do so. And all the more so if I know or have good reason to think that my dealing with him will provide him with the means of carrying out his plan. Moreover, my objection here is deontological and not merely consequentialist. That is, my objection to aiding an evil person's plan does not merely lie in its consequences, but in my participating in such evil, even if I only do so for the sake of producing some greater good. In this domain, much depends on what I could be reasonably expected to believe about the agents with whom I'm dealing. In dealing with tyrants, warlords, or gangs, I have a special responsibility to be concerned with how my dealings may advance their agendas, both directly and indirectly. Unfortunately, we need to be aware that our efforts to aid the victims of social injustice may directly or indirectly benefit the perpetrators of the injustice, enabling them to commit similar crimes in the future against the same or other groups. This is the predicament that many aid groups actually face in some of the most desperate regions on earth. Third, I've been raising deontological concerns about dealing with evil agents for the sake of aiding the needy. But as a pluralist, I also believe that we must give substantial weight to consequentialist reasons in considering our obligations to the needy. Accordingly, in contemplating support to aid groups, we must pay attention to any bad as well as any good that would result from our efforts. Considering cases where aiding the needy might benefit the very people responsible for their plight reminds us how much murkier and fraught with moral complexities our obligations to aid may be in the real world than they are in Singer's Pond case. Fourth, these considerations return us to my previous point, that aid groups seeking funds to help the needy have every incentive to top up each bit of good that they accomplish and to not look too carefully for any negative effects of their efforts. If a condition of helping the needy is that they buy a daily work permit or share some food and medicine or hire a local leader's workers, they have every incentive to assume that this is benign and to just list such costs as necessary expenses for helping needy people. And likewise, there might be little reason for an external evaluating agency to doubt the veracity of such reports or the legitimacy of such expenses. You're hiring workers. They happen to be the local leaders' workers. Who cares? You need workers. However, as seen, if the aid group is providing desperately needed help in Rwanda, and the local leader they must work with is a Hutu who's killing Tutsis, the group's impact may be much more negative than they have noted. And our assessment of the desirability of supporting such activities may change dramatically. Fifth, while I've focused on cases involving social injustice, the same worries can arise in cases involving natural misfortunes. Suppose a terrible disease or famine afflicts the poorest members of a desperately poor country. The natural temptation, motivated by the noblest of intentions, will be to help the suffering. But unlike in Singer's Pond example, the goal of aid groups will typically be to leave the victims much better off than they were before their current predicament. This might involve effecting improvements in infrastructure, water, energy, hospitals, schooling, etc. Unfortunately, however, in some regions where the need is greatest, leaders may find a way to divert some aid resources into their coffers, and in some cases, these leaders will be perpetrating unjust acts of aggression against some of their citizens or others. Thus, even if the leaders are not responsible for causing the illness or famine which prompted aid intervention, there are, as noted previously, many direct and indirect pathways by which such interventions may boost the leader's wealth, status, and power, enabling them to take advantage of their citizens' plight to further their own agendas. When those agendas are morally problematic, that must be entered on the ledger's negative side when considering the otherwise laudable goal of aiding the needy. Finally, sixth, the distinction between illnesses and natural disasters on the one hand and social injustice on the others is not always a clean one. This has a bearing on the appropriateness of learning to live with corruption for the sake of the needy. Often the catastrophic effects of earthquakes, floods, famine, or waterborne diseases such as cholera, diarrhea, malaria, typhoid, and dengue fever could have been prevented or lessened with appropriate government policies regarding building codes, dam repairs, food production, and water sanitation. Thus, often calamities are hybrid in origin, both natural and man-made. Too often, corrupt leaders choose policies that line their own pockets at the foreseeable expense of their citizens' suffering. Perhaps they accept bribes from contractors, permitting substandard building in earthquake zones. Or perhaps they spend scarce revenues on palaces rather than dam repairs or sewage plants. Or perhaps they promote poppy production from which they reap great profits rather than raising and storing food crops which could be distributed to hungry peasants during droughts. If the cost of such practices is borne by the poor and the donors of aid groups, then such leaders will have little incentive to change their ways. Worse, assuming that the corrupt leaders will find a way to profit from the misery around them by diverting some relief aid into their coffers, they will have every incentive not to alter their behavior. After all, doing so would adversely affect them on two fronts. First, by curtailing the income from the activities that help lead to such disasters, and second, by curtailing the income they receive from taking a cut of the disaster aid. Indeed, such leaders will have selfish reasons both to undermine long-term development efforts and to foster conditions that will promote future hybrid disasters. In a global environment where good-hearted people, the people in this room, are concerned to alleviate desperately poor conditions, this will provide a steady stream of revenue for their coffers. Here we see a real danger about simply learning to live with corrupt leaders who merely take advantage of their positions to greedily feather their own nests. The problem is that if we allow them to do so for the sake of aiding the needy, this may incentivize them and other greedy people in positions of power to pursue similar policies in the future. If that happens, that will place other innocent people at risk and ultimately lead to large-scale losses and human misery. Whether or not we are effective altruists, this possibility must be faced squarely in determining which, if any, aid groups to support. Section 2.7, conclusion. Can I go on 5 more minutes?
Sure.
Bring this to an end. Let me conclude with a summary and a brief look forward to Friday's lecture. I pointed out that when we give to aid groups, they may spend my gift on any number of legitimate expenses that may not be as morally compelling as saving a child. I also know that, unlike in the drowning child case, there are many intermediaries between me and my will's execution when I give to an aid group, and that this may be significant. I argue that in giving to aid groups, unlike the drowning child case, there are reasons to worry about both internal and external corruption. However, I know that internal corruption worries arise. Actually, I didn't. I took that out. Never mind. I'll just add it now. In an earlier version, I know that internal corruption worries arise for any large charity. I can't believe I missed this in 10 readings in the past. And not just for aid groups. I suggested that perhaps we should learn to live with some of our aid money being spent in many ways that we didn't intend, including, perhaps, to line the pockets of greedy people. I know that we do this for many consumer products whose acquisitions are far less important than aiding the needy. I argue that in giving to aid groups, we must be keenly attuned to the many direct or indirect ways in which our aid may inadvertently benefit the perpetrators of grave social injustice, and how in turn this may enable them and incentivize others to perpetrate similar injustices against the same or other innocents. I further know that aid resources may end up rewarding corrupt leaders whose policies have contributed to a hybrid natural and man-made disasters, and so doing incentivize them and other corrupt leaders to continue with or to adopt such policies. These worries raise doubts about the long-term wisdom of just learning to live with external corruption for the sake of aiding the needy. Complicating matters is the fact that aid groups have every incentive to emphasize the good that they accomplish and to not look for or ignore or perhaps even cover up any bad effects that their interventions may promote, and that independent evaluating agencies may not have the resources or be in a position to identify such negative impacts for themselves. Singer and effective altruists could accept most of my claims, would, I think, accept virtually all of these claims. But they remind us how disanalogous Singer's pond example is from the realities with which aid groups must often contend. However compelling Singer's example is, much more needs to be considered before one can determine the overall merits of giving to aid groups. A duty to support aid groups does not directly follow from the duty to save a drowning child. In my final lecture, I will raise new questions about perverse incentives and about important distortional effects to which aid resources can give rise. I shall also raise a particularly vexing problem regarding the conflict between individual and collective morality. This will be the single most important philosophical contribution to these three lectures. What goes on in the next lecture? I will conclude by taking stock of these lectures' main claims and implications. I will note some of the most important unresolved issues and consider where we should go from here regarding our treatment of the needy. Thank you so very, very much.